I'm Josie Mitchell, and this is the Granter Magazine podcast, where we speak to authors about their novels, memoirs, story collections, and poetry. Jamaica Kincaid is a widely acclaimed author who was born and grew up on the island of Antigua. She went to the US aged 17 to work as an au pair, and in time came to write short pieces for The New Yorker. A number of her fiction pieces, published in the 1970s and 80s, were released as a story collection, The Bottom of the River. The first of those stories, Girl, was described by the Haitian-American novelist Edward Stantikat as one of the most anthologized stories in the English-speaking world. Kincaid went on to write many books, including the remarkable Annie John, which recalls the childhood and adolescence of a precocious, unruly, and at times sadistic young Antiguan girl. In total, 5 books, including these two, will be reissued this year by Picador in the UK as part of a renewed examination and celebration of Jamaica Kincaid's writing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And it's lovely to be talking about your work in this context where all of your books, or many of your books, so 5 this year and 5 next year, are getting reissued in the UK. How does that feel to have these books sort of brought out again?
Surprised. I won't say being young, but I don't want to harp too much on not being young anymore, though I feel awfully young. But it feels wonderful to know. I think it feels wonderful to know that people might get to read them. I think especially that Black people might get to read them. You know, when I first started to write, I was published primarily in the New Yorker magazine. And I think there might have been 100 people out of the million people. They had a very high number of subscribers. And I don't know if they had 100 Black people, but when I had readings in my early years of writing, the audience was predominantly white. And I would think, I guess no Black people like me. And I certainly wasn't the toast of the island I come from, because I said things that people didn't like to hear. But over the years, that's changed. And I suspect being published here again, I'll get some readers from the Caribbean, especially. That would be the most wonderful thing. I've always envied African-American writers who have a community of readers. You know, they write about the experience of being an African-American. And though I identify on the census as African-American, I'm not really, I don't. And though I know very, very deeply the African-American story in America and identify with it, I'm not really, you know, the way Alice Walker is, say, for instance.
That makes me want to ask as well about what it's like to be in the UK or to come to the UK.
Oh.
You know, because it's a very different relationship, I think. As you said, you're from Antigua. I've read some of your superb essays on a strong, you know, at times framed as ambivalence, at the times, you know, I think legitimate hatred towards this country.
Yes, that word is... don't hesitate to use hatred.
You use the word, and I think you use it well, and you support it with some superb arguments. Maybe we could talk a bit about that sort of
absolutely
where that comes from and your relationship to the country and how it's evolved.
Yeah, it's so good of you to ask me this. I don't think I write about it from America, but I've never really spoken about it in this country. I think, you know, it's clear to me, very, very clear to me, that if I had been sent to this country instead of America, I would not be sitting here speaking to you. The gateways to being a complete person, if you are Black, Or of African descent in this country are not very open. There are not many gates and they are not open. I don't think I would have been the kind of writer that I became. For one thing, you know, when you live with people who have harmed you, it's not, you can't help but have some sympathy or some feeling of affection for them, and it blunts your ability to look straight at things. You know, the familiarity modifies your truth, the truth of what's happened. So I'm glad I went to America and could look at this country. But I come to the funny thing is, I've been to this country, and I say this country because the UK, many, many times, you know.
You had a sort of, just to frame it, I guess, for people, you've described having a very British education, right? Like, you're having this sort of fetishized image of England.
Absolutely.
Given to you as a small child in
absolutely.
These schools.
Absolutely, I could.
A curriculum
name.
Organized by a British, presumably, man.
Yes, someone in the colonial office who went to Eton and Oxford or Cambridge or someplace like that designed our education. It's amazing to me if how people from all over the of my generation, all over what used to be the British Empire, we all have the same memories of Wordsworth and Coolidge and Milton. And I think you generally stops at Kipling. So I come here many times and I always look at Trafalgar Square, but I've never been near it until last June, month before last June, I finally just walked around it. And I think this time I will go into it. And the reason is, for one thing, I grew up on Nelson Street. I grew up in a neighborhood in Antigua that had five streets named after English criminals, really. The first street was Rodney. I lived on Nelson. Then there was Hawkins and Hood and then Drake, these five streets. No one ever told us the incredibly horrible part they played in our lives and our ancestors and the history that they played in the West Indies. I can never remember if it's Hawkins or Hood who was knighted by Elizabeth I for introducing a new trade to England. And the new trade was the slave trade. He had kidnapped a ship of slaves. He was sort of a pirate, and he kidnapped a ship of slaves from the Spanish and sold them and brought the money back to England, and she knighted him. And I think his coat of arms was a black man kneeling with his hands tied. That was his coat of arms. We lived on streets named after these people. And Antigua and Nelson are particularly intertwined. Nelson, I think, ran the West Indies, the British West Indies from Antigua. And there is a place, a very famous sailing destination in Antigua called Nelson's Dockyard. And we don't really think about it. All of these things are so deeply embedded in our memory. You know, the place we come from, the place we call home, is the home of our suffering. So the people responsible for our suffering lives here. So I have very complicated, no, not complicated. They're quite obvious feelings of
just
despair and hatred and so on. Not enough to do anything about it other than to write about it.
But that's doing a lot. I'm going to quote you, actually, because I think you write about it very well. I think, because one thing you write about very well in a book called A Small Place is this idea of like England as myth and coming across it. And I think in also this book, an essay where you talk about visiting England for the first time.
Yes, on seeing.
And I think it's from that essay that you say, the space between the idea of something and its reality is always wide and deep and dark.
Yes.
So that was very beautifully put.
It's not disappointments, how many revelations. I mean, when I grew up and began to see plays and come to England myself or Great Britain myself, I was shocked at how poor ordinary people were. I just assumed that all this stuff you got from the empire, that you were all swimming in gold. I didn't realize that it was the 1% that got the riches of the empire. So, you know, there's a show called Call the Midwife, and it's about England in the 50s and so on. And you just can't believe that how poor people are. I think I hadn't realized how unjust the thing called England was to its own people. And so that's another complication to think about. You know, if you can treat your own people that way, why would you treat us any better? And it also gave me ideas about why you all were always leaving. You're always going somewhere. Oh, God. I don't think there's anybody who goes places more than English people. They just can't stay in England. And then the minute they get to the place where they're going, they turn it into England. And then they tell you, you can never go to England because you're not worthy. But they never go back. It's very complicated. Well, no, it's not. It's amusing.
I love the sense of humour that so often you find with these actually quite devastating sort of stories, actually, in some ways. Like there's a sort of sardonic feel that I think is very empowering, actually. It feels like it gives you a lot of power in the way you tell the story, that you find it just kind of funny. Can I ask what you wanted to be when you were a small child?
It is true that everyone who knew me as a child, and they're not surprised that I became a writer, because apparently I would pretend I was writing all the time. I would sit at an imaginary desk and write. To imagine my future as a child, I suppose I might have thought, well, the possibility of becoming a teacher or a nurse. A nurse was very much something I might have done, because there's a nursing training school in Antigua, so I might have done. That might be something, but I read so much, and I was always reading, and I was always chatting and not doing really what I was supposed to do. Mostly I read when I was supposed to be doing something else. And it seemed to me now that I must have in some way thought I might be a scholar or something. I might, do something with books. That would be teaching. But I think my imagining myself as an adult was prescribed, I think would be the word, by what was available to me, what was possible for me. Teacher, perhaps, nurse, but not writing.
I know that you've said that reading is really important to you, and I think I've read your writing on libraries as a a sort of institution that has been really valuable to you. Yeah, what do libraries represent for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, oh, my mother, you know, my mother was a great reader, and I didn't understand at the time, and she would take me everywhere with her, and she'd usually carrying me because I couldn't walk fast enough. So she'd take me to the library and she'd sit there and read, and I would interrupt her. And so she taught me to read. And she taught me to read. I didn't know there was an ABC, an alphabet. She just taught me to read from a book she was reading. The book she was reading was a biography of Louis Pasteur. And I remember it because she said he is the reason she boiled my milk. She was pasteurizing it, she said. That word came from him. So
that's a remarkable conversation to have with a small child.
Which I suppose so. Now, at seven, when I did something wrong, I had to, my punishment was to copy books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost. And it had the opposite effect of subduing me.
I was going to say it's an interesting text to then sort of encourage obedience, isn't it?
Yes. Better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. I did not know what that meant, but I loved that.
That's a remarkable moment, actually, because obviously those two books, you have Satan thrown out of heaven, which we've talked about already.
Yes.
You were saying you had England described as heaven to you.
Yes.
And sort of pushing back against this dominant
power. You know, you can read Annie John as the relationship between colony and mother country.
Is that something you were thinking about when you wrote it originally?
Not when I was writing it, but I came to see that parental relationships between parent and child were very much mirrored by the way we behaved, colony and mother country, that the way our parents were treated by the colonial power were the way we were treated. You know, the same sort of cruelty and strictness and judgments and belittling.
And regulation
and rules.
One of the things that is so striking about Annie John, you know, is this sort of the regulation, you know, of how things are done and the rhythms by which people do things and how neat everybody has to be. And
yes.
It's really striking.
All in line. Yes. Those were rules that you could find in a lot of colonial societies. There were rules of about how we were to behave that you would never find in England or in Great Britain.
Or it seemed even that the English people or British people who were there weren't necessarily even being held to the same standards.
Oh, no, they would never be. Yeah.
Because it's an amazing account of the mother sort of cleaning, making sure the child is incredibly clean in order to be treated by a doctor.
Yes.
It's quite shocking.
That awful doctor who had his own peculiar history. You know, he was a refugee from the Holocaust, but we didn't know that. So he had his own cruel trauma, and he came to live with us, and he never told us that he had suffered. We might have been very sympathetic and loving and to him. He never told us, but he just visited this cruelty on us. The funny thing is, he and my mother got along so well, because they both liked the body. My mother was very interested in my body, what I ate, and did it come out? Did it go in properly? Did it come out properly? I always liked being just outside looking at things. I love singing, but I've never wanted to be a singer. I like being a backup singer. Do you know who Holly Woodlawn is?
I don't.
Oh, she's one of those trans women who worked with Andy Warhol, Candy Darling, Jackie Curtis, and Holly Woodlawn. And then after they had their moment, well, I don't know, Holly must have fallen out with Andy. She had a nightclub act, and I was one of her backup singers.
That's amazing.
We used to play nightclubs.
Really?
Yes, yeah.
How did you get into that?
I can't really remember how I auditioned for it. And I was reading her her autobiography, and she said that, I think she said I was a terrible singer, but oh, we got terrible reviews, got such bad reviews, and we were terrible, all deserved. And then, so the band disbanded, and then somehow they got started again, and they found a replacement. And the replacement was this waitress in Max's Kansas City, whose husband had a band, and her name was Debbie, and it's Debbie Harry.
Wow. That's amazing. No way.
Yeah. I didn't know that my replacement was Debbie Harry, but I read it in Holly's.
So you found that out recently.
Yes.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
But do you find yourself in these sort of situations often?
Where I turn, I used to be, as I say, just sort of on the margins of a lot of things that I now read about, but I never wanted to be part of any scene. I really wanted to be, once I discovered that it was possible to be a writer, I just wanted to be a writer.
It's got a few threads going on here, you know. We've talked about you coming around to the idea of writing, and we've talked about Annie John, which was your first novel.
It was first novel, but I'd written these short stories before. Well, I don't know if you can call them. They're short. I don't know what you'd call them.
And they're collected together in one of the books that's being reissued, right?
Yes, at the bottom of the river. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm interested in what it must be like going back and thinking about these books, because in a way, I don't know how much you've been thinking about them these years since it's been many years since they were published.
Yes. First of all, I never read my writing unless someone asks me to or pays me to do it. I wouldn't, I don't go back and read it at all. If they were not republished, I wouldn't have been talking about them.
If you, have you reread them?
No.
No. Yeah, wow. So you must have these. So what you have is this memory of the thing, which is maybe...
I have for some cast with this memory. In fact, again, when I was a child, and I would remember everything that had happened. And at first, people were quite complimentary. They'd say, oh, what a memory you have. It's so great. And then I began to remember the things that everybody wanted to forget. And I would remind them, they'd say, oh, shut up, you know, as if, and would make me feel my memory wasn't to be trusted. But I trust it very much. I very much depend on it. You know, as a child, as a school child, my favorite subjects were history, geography, and botany. Well, I don't know if geography and botany, if they would come under being the daughters of memory, but history is a daughter of memory, and it, if I were to worship, that's the god I would worship. She's a
you'd worship memory.
Yes, and she's one of the, she's Zeus's sister, you know, but people don't really assign her too much. She doesn't really do anything. She just has her daughters, but they are the foundation of civilization. Memory is the foundation of civilization. Her children. Yeah,
that is a thing that I I'm struck by when I do read your writing, actually. Yeah, there's that attention to strange things that an adult wouldn't normally remember about childhood.
Oh,
like the name of this bird, Percy, and what he does.
Oh, that was so, I couldn't get over that. There are so, and again, I think, you know, my subconscious, I just so truly believe in it. And if I were to be afraid of losing the ability of anything, it would be that losing touch with my unconscious. Whatever that is, I don't really know what it is. But
maybe that would be my final question to you. What is the role that you give to your unconscious with your writing? What does your unconscious offer you? And how do you work? How does that work?
Oh, wow. Well, I believe that when I'm writing, I want to be in a state, and I don't know how to achieve it, really, but I try for it, to know everything and to know nothing at once. It's just something I hope for, that's the state I want to be in, to just know everything there that I want to know, and yet to know nothing, and just to proceed in that sort of darkness, in a kind of darkness, and that as I go along, there will be a little headlamp with a lone, not necessarily bright beam of light, but a beam of light just ploughing along into the darkness.
Darkness visible. Which I'm sure is a theme I see and notice in your work.
I mean, it's such a big influence on me. Paradise Lost is just it's just so, you know, one of the words Christopher Columbus uses over and over, when he first encounters what we now call the West Indies, he kept using the word paradise. It's a paradise. And of course, when you pause to think it's a paradise, the unspoken words is, and I will violate it.
You've been listening to the Granton Magazine podcast. Please do subscribe if you'd like to hear more of these episodes, and give us a rating if you enjoyed this one. And if you're keen to find more great writing, check out granton.com.